This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
I'm Dr. Brian Weiss, author of Many Lives, Many Masters and Same Soul, Many Bodies. And I'd just like to say that Living Dialogues with Duncan Campbell is one of my favorite shows. Duncan has such a rich and textured experience that he shares with his listeners. And being a guest on the show is so wonderful to me because the integration of Duncan's experiences and my experiences is so perfectly blended. It's not one-sided as so many shows are. This gives me an opportunity to think. The questions are provocative and to listen and learn from Duncan's experiences too. This is really part of the show that makes it special. The nature of the show, the essence of the show is shared communication, it's shared experience, shared wisdom, and then almost the dialectic, the one stimulating the other, bringing it to a higher level, a higher octave than could be just from me hearing myself talk. So I want to express my appreciation to you, Duncan, for having me on the show and for the wonderful format that you present. Everybody that listens to your show are very privileged.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a dia flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular dialogue, I'm truly delighted to have as my guest, Brian Weiss, MD, author of many books, most recently, Same Soul, Many Bodies, Discover the Healing Power of Future Lives Through Progression Therapy. Brian graduated magna cum laude from Columbia University and received his medical degree from the Yale University School of Medicine. He served his internship at New York University's Bellevue Medical Center and went on to become chief resident, Department of Psychiatry, at the Yale University School of Medicine. He is now chairman emeritus of psychiatry at the Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami. Brian Weiss is the author, as mentioned, of a number of best-selling books, including Many Lives, Many Masters, and Through Time into Healing. He leads seminars, workshops, and professional training programs throughout the world. He is married and lives in Miami, Florida. So, Brian, it's really a true delight to have you back on this program, Living Dialogues.
Thank you very much, Duncan. It's great to be back with you.
In the past, we visited the extraordinary story that you tell in Many Lives, Many Masters of how you first came into this awareness that became your life work, that you were, we might say, a very accomplished psychiatrist in a conventional modality and had written a number of monographs, maybe 30 or 40 monographs, within the parameters of, again, we might say, you know, the psychiatry as is known in the mainstream. And then one day you were regressing one of your patients, Catherine, and she just kept going past zero and into the past, into past lives. And I think maybe just to give people a sense of it that maybe hearing about you for the first time, I'd like you to tell, if you wouldn't mind, the story of your son. And how moving that was, and how it really changed your life that she began speaking about your first son who died shortly after childbirth, and maybe you could just take it from there.
Absolutely, because that was the epiphany for me. That was the moment that my whole world changed. Before that, a few weeks before that, she had started to remember past lifetimes. I did not believe in this. Mm-hmm. They don't teach this at Yale Medical School, a very conservative place.
Even today.
Even today, they do not. I've spoken back at Yale, but in the theology school, not in the medical school.
Very interesting. Yeah.
So when she started to remember past lives, and this came about somewhat, I'll say coincidentally, even though there may not be coincidences, she had been suffering from panic attacks, phobias, fears. A Catholic woman, Catherine at that time was in her late 20s, and I had treated her for more than a year with psychotherapy because she wouldn't take any medication because of a fear of choking or gagging. Finally, she let me use hypnosis. She had visited Chicago and the King Tut exhibit that was touring the country and began to correct the museum guide about everyday Egyptian artifacts. And she was correct, but she didn't know where this information came from. So what I was telling her, that perhaps she had repressed or forgotten childhood memories, might be accurate. We used hypnosis, went back, found traumas in her childhood, but no real change in her clinical status. So the next week when she was in, I told her to go back to the time where her symptoms first began. And that's when she started remembering past lives, because she went back about 4,000 years into an ancient Near Eastern lifetime. I'll just digress a little bit. Because I did not let Simon & Schuster, the editor, change any of the audio tapes I was making of the sessions, hoping that people would get in touch with me and fill in the missing pieces. This is what happened. For example, in that first lifetime, and she drowned in a flood or tidal wave, 80-foot or 60-foot waves knocking over trees and buildings in her village, which was somewhere in the eastern Mediterranean. I couldn't fathom how 80-foot waves could exist in the eastern Mediterranean. This is like tsunami stuff. This is not in the Mediterranean. And her, by the way, her lifelong fear of gagging disappeared after that memory. And so...
So she must have drowned.
She drowned, and the gagging disappeared. This is how past life therapy has its therapeutic effects. A geologist wrote me that that was the story of the eruption of the great volcano on Thera, which is now known as Santorini. The time was correct. It caused 80-foot waves all the way to Greece and Asia Minor and the northern coast of Egypt. So actually she was describing what's described in Exodus. Day turning into night. There was so much ash. There was no summer that year on the earth. That was the eruption of the volcano in Thera.
Amazing. And I'll just interject here. One of the persons that's been on this program as well is Graham Hancock, whose work Underworld, his book, verifies that the story of the Great Flood that appears in the Bible is a story that's told in many, many different traditions. And in fact, he shows through the latest archaeological evidence and his own deep diving off the coastal plains of various places around the world that there is evidence to show that there was indeed a great flood in many of these places, and it is in the living memory through legends, but that our quote modern scientific mind sort of drew a line between our history and quote prehistory, thinking that everything before that was just fanciful and made up or didn't have any actual reality to it. And then to have someone like Catherine in this progression come forth with what amounts to living testimony.
Yes.
It's quite extraordinary.
It was. I didn't realize it at the time, though, because I wasn't aware of the eruption myself. So that's why I wanted the experts to fill in the blank. So even that, though, wasn't enough for me, because I thought, well, maybe this is imagination or fantasy or metaphor, symbol, like in a dreamlike state or in a Freudian psychoanalytic sense. But about the fourth or fifth lifetime, and her symptoms were disappearing too, which doesn't fit clinically. Imagination doesn't cure such chronic symptoms. She was floating in a space in between lifetimes, and she said to me, there are two people to see you, your father and your son. Nobody knew about my father and my son. I don't even have my diplomas hanging in my office. One theory of psychotherapy is you don't want your patient to know about you. You want them to project their feelings and
onto
thoughts.
Onto a tabula rasa.
Exactly right. Yeah,
blank slate.
Yes. Right. Yes, the transference reaction. And so when she started talking about my father and my son with great factual accuracy, she said, your father's here. She gave me his name. He died from his heart. Your daughter is named after him. All of this true. And your son is here and very tiny and shining brightly. And his heart is important also because it's turned around backwards. And then she went into why he died and the importance of that and what it meant. Nobody knew about my son who had died, my first son, a decade earlier in New York City. This therapy with Catherine was happening in Miami, Florida. there was no place for her to look it up. She was a laboratory technician in the hospital, not an FBI agent, not an investigative reporter, mm-hmm. and certainly no money or interest to even if it were findable, she wouldn't have found it, and it wasn't. So exactly, that's what my son had died from a decade earlier as an infant, and this shocked me because I knew that this was not imagination.
And more than that, she knew why he had come here and what effect he had on you and your wife, Carol. Perhaps you could share that.
Absolutely. He came here to help us learn our lessons and to teach us. And I've been thinking about this a lot, Duncan, since then, that without my son's death, I probably never would have written Many Lives, Many Masters and not be doing this work now, 8 books later, and chance, you know, traveling all over the world, helping people and learning from people and teaching people. Because going through a personal grief, and this was way before Catherine, of that nature, losing a child, you never want anyone else, any other living being, to suffer from grief. So anything you can do to help them. So as I was beginning regression therapy with my patients, I was finding that patients with grief were feeling better, doing better, wanting to know more. And so I decided finally, after 5 years of foot dragging and hedging and worrying about my professional reputation, I was chairman of the psychiatry department and had an international reputation in psychopharmacology by this time.
Very respectable.
Very.
Within the profession.
Oh,
yes.
Yes.
And accomplished. Yes.
Yeah. That I needed to write this down. So I wrote this long case history, about 120 pages, because I had recorded all of her sessions. Mm-hmm. And it was much too long for a medical report. So it became a book. Then it was found out of the ether by Simon & Schuster. The New Age editor there called me. I didn't know how to shop a book. Mm-hmm. But apparently one of my patients was a friend. She called saying, what about your book? So there were other forces at work. And so I think without the death of my son, I don't think I would have written the book. Maybe I would have done the research, but I don't think I would have taken the professional risk.
Well, in fact, and when you say other forces at work, I think that's another thing that we can bring in here, that a part of this emerging understanding and the evolution of consciousness and moving beyond just the, we might call it the left brain mainstream understanding of reality. As we're slowly coming to reactivate knowledge that's there, I think, from our own indigenous roots, that the world is very multidimensional. And how did Shakespeare put it? Horatio, there are many more things under the sun than you can imagine in your philosophy, or something more elegant than that. But the same kind of breaking wave of consciousness is beginning to happen. And I think of Carolyn Mace's work on sacred contracts, or James Hillman, the great Jungian thinker, on the soul's code, where they both go back to Plato. And they say in Plato's philosophy, he described how before we come in to incarnation, taking reincarnation for granted, that we have a mission. And we agree to it. And then we cross the river of forgetfulness when we go through the birth canal and we come in. And actually, part of our life's progression and learning is to find out again what it is that we are meant to do and then to do that. And what I was struck by in Catherine's recounting of or channeling of the story of your son, coming from, as you put it, the masters, because it came through a different voice, was that your son had been a very accomplished being and been through many, many lifetimes and soul's unfoldment, and he came in voluntarily to go through this tragedy of being born with the heart backward and dying a very premature death in order to open your heart. And your wife's heart, you know, that was his sacrifice. And it was all linked with this larger purpose where you, in a sense, were chosen as a man of destiny to have had the education at Columbia, to be magna cum laude, to go to the Yale University School of Medicine, to write the 30 monographs and have the reputation in pharmacology, so that when you then became the spokesperson for this new consciousness, you couldn't be dismissed as some kind of flaky, imaginative, weirdo, but that actually your very straightness for so many years was definitely part of the whole preparation for you to be the messenger of this kind of consciousness.
Exactly right. I found throughout the world that that's gotten my foot in the door, the credibility factor, mm-hmm. going through Columbia, going through Yale Medical School, writing these papers and my previous book, which we're not talking about, The Biology of Cholinergic Function, a much earlier book. This is the credibility factor, and this is why people listen. When they listen, something begins to resonate within them. Mm-hmm. Many physicians have come up to me over the years and therapists and said, don't tell anyone, but... And then these marvelous stories of their own experiences come out. Mm-hmm. That nobody wants to be considered weird or strange or crazy, none of us. And yet these things are not. Mm-hmm. They're within the realm of consciousness. The most mystical people today, to me, or among the most mystical people, are the physicists writing about string theory and multiple dimensions and multiple universes and parallel universes mm-hmm. and proving it mathematically. This is why all the past and futuristic work they agree with, because there is no time. And every time we make a decision, they write, and prove, we create more universes. For example, my decision to come on your show, your decision to invite me, has created a new universe, mm-hmm. other than the one where I didn't come to Boulder. Mm-hmm. And yet here I am, so we're off along this universe. And I don't know where the Brian Weiss or the Duncan Campbell is who... Mm-hmm. which universe, if I had not come here, if we were not doing this show. But they prove this mathematically, and it has tremendous implications. We are multidimensional beings. One quote that I like very much is from the mystic Teilhard de Chardin, mm-hmm. who said, "We are not human beings having a spiritual experience, but we are spiritual beings having a human experience."
Yes.
He captures the nuance of our real core. Now, spiritual beings can exist in multiple dimensions and are not limited by the confines of the physical body. They never die because they're never really born. They existed before the physical body and will exist afterwards. And that's us. We never die either. And so this is in indigenous traditions. This is in all religions. This is a well-known concept. But we have forgotten this in modern culture. We act as if we're just physical beings. We're acting almost unidimensionally, mm-hmm. and we're not. We're multidimensional beings who can never be harmed, not at that level. And the world needs to be reminded of this. Otherwise, this schoolhouse will eventually close.
The schoolhouse of this planet may actually. It's true, without being, apocalyptic, we could say that the experiment that we're undergoing as a planetary species may or may not prove out. And it may be that if we end up destroying ourselves through nuclear war or whatever disease, global warming, that the whole mass will fall back into the evolutionary muck, and then consciousness will reform in another form, and it could be hominid, it could be something else, but it will continue forward. So the concern about the planet dying is really, in a sense, misplaced, because the planet will survive one way or the other.
For sure.
Yes. It's a question of whether we will.
Right.
You know.
That caused me that concern as I was looking into future lifetimes. I work a lot with large groups of people, mm-hmm. and so I started progressing people into the future. I'm not talking now about individual patients, and that's described a lot in the new book, but I'm talking about in these large groups progressing people to three distinct time periods in the future.
And let's hold on right there before you get into the detail, Brian. What caused the shift in your work from the attention to regressing people into past lives and then the current focus of your latest book onto progressing first groups of people and then individuals into future lifetimes?
It was happening spontaneously anyway. I just mm-hmm. hadn't been writing about it because my thinking was past lives is enough for people to digest at this point. And a lot of people were still having problems with that, of course. So
of course.
To spend years validating it, proving it, showing its therapeutic power and efficacy. Mm-hmm. Future lives, wow, this is something even more. But now after 24 years of doing this work and watching people spontaneously experience future lives, have precognitive dreams,
yes.
all of these things that I knew about but hadn't written about, then I decided, okay, I'm going to write about this now. I'm getting older and I better get it down on paper because I want people to know that this goes beyond time. Our future lives are dependent on our actions now. just as you and I in the present time at this very moment are the result of our past actions, our past thoughts, our past decisions, when our sitting here now was a future time.
This is so interesting because I was trained for many years in the Tantric Buddhist tradition from a Tibetan Lama, and he taught what is called the Abhidharma in his particular way, and he taught the notion of auspicious coincidence, which in the ancient Buddhist way of looking at the world is that Duncan and Brian are here in this moment in time, ineluctably, inescapably, because a series of choices that we've made to get here to this very moment. But from this moment on, the old song, you know, anything could happen. I mean, we could get up and leave the room without finishing this. We could finish it. We don't know yet what's to come in the next few minutes. And so everything from this point on is a totally open possibility. And the fascinating thing in your current work is that the future that is yet to come could have an influence on where we are now. And that's the kind of mind bender, because I think one of the things that you have really contributed to greatly in opening people's consciousness to the reality of past lives is the many stories where, for instance, I think there was one Irish woman that you talked about who had certain past life experiences, but she had living children that could be consulted from that past life and who said only our mother could have known this. And so that sort of helps the conventional educated mind make the bridge to this non-tangible, non-contemporary reality as being real. But to go into the future is a different kind of leap. And so let's explore how that came about and how that works, of how a future life could have an impact on our choices in the present life.
Conceptually, think about it as parallel events, parallel universes or parallel lifetimes, simultaneous rather than sequential. Mm-hmm. Things here in this plane seem longitudinal, time. It appears to flow from past to present to future. But what if it's all simultaneous? Then you can have future memories. As strange as that sounds, as oxymoronish as it sounds, mm-hmm. It's not. So you can jump from one time stream to another. The past is happening right now, really, as is the future. And so what I found out, that people remembering the future, that was starting to change them in the present time. Mm-hmm. They were remembering future lives, and that was influencing them now to make different decisions. And then, as in the Abhidharma, mm-hmm. anything could happen, because they started making different decisions. Their understanding changed. Their choices changed. So the karma, and by the way, this is not an Eastern concept only. Karma just means what you sow, that's what you reap. You can find it in all the religions.
That's right. Yeah.
And that was changing because of what they viewed in the future. Then they would change their lives in the present, and that created a different future. So, for example, Gary, the person you mentioned briefly, who did not commit suicide in this life because he viewed his future life then changed to something completely different the next time that I progressed him into the future.
And this is what's so fascinating, and I'd like you to maybe take 3 or 4 minutes and just summarize the story of Gary, because I think it really makes it so much easier for people to understand when it's put in a story form. And this is an actual patient of yours, and I found it quite intriguing, the story and the outcome, because I think at this point in time, particularly as we go through this major initiation of moving from a kind of consciousness in which we've all been educated through family or institutional churches or universities or whatever has shaped our consciousness of what's real and what's not. It's a stretch for many people to actually move beyond that kind of sense that we are our physical body, and if things aren't going well for us in life, maybe the thing to do is just end it all, you know. And so the Hamlet question really is very intimate for many people in some time in their life, that to be or not to be. And this was Gary's dilemma when he encountered you.
Yes, this was a man around 40, early 40s, who came to see me announcing that he was going to commit suicide. He was coming for 2 sessions because of a promise he made to his wife, I believe. But nothing I said or would say could change his mind.
And why was he so depressed?
He was depressed not because of biological depression, but because his business was failing. And there was shame involved. He was facing bankruptcy and lawsuit, and he couldn't face this.
And it went back to what his father had told him, how his father had shamed him in his early life by saying, you will never amount to anything. The father was a construction worker. He thought his boy was a bit of a sissy, kind of, you're more like a girl than a boy. You're so intellectual. And so he blocked Gary at many levels, and Gary persevered nonetheless and had made an actual flourishing art business, and it was taking good care of his two sons that were going to college. He had a loving wife, but then he made a mistake of judgment as to where the art market was going, overinvested in inventory, and then all of a sudden was facing personal financial disaster, which made him very vulnerable to that old voice of the father that had been internalized.
Absolutely. His father didn't believe that art or art history was the proper choice, and it and he said Gary would never amount to anything. So this shame was compounded by what was happening now. It turned out it was even more complicated, although Gary didn't realize this at the time. His partner had been embezzling money. Mm-hmm. So part of the failure of the business was out of his control, but this was unknown at that moment.
And he had a bogus lawsuit from
the partner
trying to cover himself
up as well.
Yes, exactly.
But he didn't realize it was bogus at that time.
Exactly.
So Gary, in the and as a psychiatrist, this is the almost the worst thing you can hear, because it means just about that you have to hospitalize that person, even against his will, if he announces, no matter what I say, he's going to commit suicide, for his safety.
Now, it's your professional duty.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But there was something about him where I talked to him, and he promised to give me some time, these sessions. He was having a dream. He had a dream of him holding a gun to his head. And I went into his, what I thought would be a past life, of him holding a gun to his head. But I knew he hadn't committed suicide yet. There was no gun. But it turned out to be a future life. Again, his life was going to become unraveled. It had to do with he was married to his boss's wife in the future life, and there was a relationship found out, and this was going to come to no good end.
He was having an affair with the boss's wife?
No, I think he was married to her, and he was...
Oh, I see.
He was having another affair.
To the boss's daughter.
The boss's daughter, I'm sorry.
Married to the boss's daughter, and then having an affair, which would have caused daddy to be very angry.
The boss's daughter.
And he would have lost his job and his reputation. And
same kind of shame again. And and he said to me something like, am I doomed to keep repeating this?
The same scenario of having to kill himself in lifetime after lifetime.
And I found that in my work looking in past lives that people who do commit suicide, and I'm not talking about from severe mental illness or terminal illness with severe pain. This is a different matter. But here he was a healthy 40-ish man with shame, healthy body, fairly healthy mind otherwise. Yes, childhood influences from his father, but no history of depression before this. Mm-hmm. He didn't realize the effect it would have on his wife, on his children. And so we looked in this, and I said, no, if you take a different choice now, if you look at this, and then we did this visualization work that I've been doing where you come to a, in a deep hypnotic state, to a fork in the road, anybody having to make a decision. Look down the left path, the right path, see if one is wide and lighted up, one is narrow and dark and tortuous. You're getting a sign. And then we looked at the consequences of his behavior. Committing suicide, he saw the devastation it brought to his family. He saw the future life with the gun at his head, taking that path. But the other path, not committing suicide, he saw things weren't as bad as it seemed. People understood that bankruptcies happen. His workers understood, the ones he had to lay off. His family understood. And it wasn't so bad. He chose that path. By the way, when we looked at a future lifetime, it was completely different. The bankruptcy happened. The lawsuit happened. He won the lawsuit. His children, everyone forgave him. He was able to start a new business, hire back many of the workers he had to lay off. It wasn't so bad. And then in his future life, it was completely different. No gun, no boss's daughter, none of this stuff was there. You can't prove it, But here we have a man who did not commit suicide because of a progression into the future.
It's quite fascinating because I remember reading the story where he was so depressed because he was sure his wife wouldn't love him, that his children would resent terribly the shame of being the children of a bankrupt father, that he wouldn't be able to pay for their college education, and everybody would hate him, and all that self-recrimination and self-hatred he projected onto his wife and sons. And he found out when he did this future dream, if you will, a future memory, I thought that was a wonderful phrase, that looking back on it, if he had taken that path of shooting himself, that they were in terrible agony. They were blaming themselves, oh, if we'd only done this or that. And he was causing them untold pain and self-recrimination, exactly the opposite of what he had intended to do. He just wanted to get out of their way and remove himself so that he wouldn't be a pain for them. And it had just the exact opposite effect.
Yes.
And then in the other life, when he saw himself choosing the other fork, of course, it turned out that they did love him and blah, 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 and so on. And what I was reminded of was this great article in The New Yorker about suicides off the Golden Gate Bridge, and it was called Jumpers. And it actually chronicled the number of people who've committed suicide off the Golden Gate Bridge from its inception to the present. This was about, I don't know, maybe 2002 or 2003 in The New Yorker. And there were a handful of people who survived. And one of them survived, I'm sure, to be able to tell this story and to have this story heard by someone like me or anyone else reading this article, where he said, the moment after I jumped, he couldn't have been more than 5 or 10 feet in the air, he said, I realized instantaneously that there was nothing in my life that couldn't be repaired, nothing that couldn't be made right except for one thing, and that's the decision I had just made. And it was such a powerful story. And here you've got additional evidence in the story of Gary and others like him that can give people in that terrible no exit sense of despair a realistic way of getting out of it without medication, or giving them some possibility to see, yes, you know, to almost see the experience that this man had, and then he lived to tell about it. If he hadn't lived, we would all be full of fear.
Yes, and that happens so many times. People who change their decisions based on their look into the future or the past, because if you know that people who commit suicide turn around more quickly, you're not going to do it and recreate the same process.
Well, we've abruptly come to the end of this particular dialogue, unfortunately. And I just want to say, Brian, I'm looking forward to the next one. It's just terrific to have you back on the program. I'm enjoying it very, very much.
Thank you so much, Duncan.
I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. I'm speaking with Brian Weiss, MD, author of Same Soul, Many Bodies. Be with us as we continue on Living Dialogues. And if you have enjoyed this dialogue between myself and Brian Weiss, part two of the dialogue will be automatically downloaded to your computer in the coming weeks as part of your subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media. And if you'd like to obtain a CD or MP3 of the full two-part dialogue, or additional dialogues I've done with Brian Weiss or other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, you can contact me at Duncan@Personal Life Media or through my website, livingdialogues.com. That's livingdialogues, DIALOGUES.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the best.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.